Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey, this is Adam from Toronto, and I support Creative Control because Vish is full stop one of the best arts interviewers in Canada, or anywhere in the world, really. He approaches every episode like he's known the artist for years, creating a conversational atmosphere that gets straight to the heart of the work. No one else in podcasting gets it quite right like he does, with a mixture of meticulous research, wise artistic insights, and well-humored personal connections. I proudly support Vish and Creative Control on Patreon. You should too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Carson McCone is a talented songwriter, poet, singer, artist, and musician currently based near Welland, Ontario. Originally from Austin, Texas, McCone has released 3 albums to date, including a wondrous new one called Still Life, which was recorded and co-produced with her life partner and musical collaborator, Daniel Romano. Still Life was released on February 25th, 2022 by Merge Records, and it prompted Carson and I to have a lovely conversation about American and Canadian niceties, finding a community in Canada, and what she makes of the state of Texas and its vast landscape these days. The writings of Cormac McCarthy and George Saunders, how Still Life compares to her previous record, Carousel, what it was like recording music relatively instinctually and impulsively with Daniel Romano, her membership in Daniel Romano's outfit, upcoming tour dates, recordings, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you, who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol with additional support from Blackbird Music, a well-stocked record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and friendly staff who will help you with just about everything you need in terms of ordering records. You can learn more about them at blackbird.ca. plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 672 of Creative Control, featuring the gifted and wise Carson McHone with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Carson. How's it going?
Hey, great, Vish. Thank you.
Nice to have you on the show. You didn't ask me how I was. What is that about? Sometimes I grill people about this. Americans never say. It's like percentage-wise, statistically, Americans never ask me how I am. What's going on?
Oh, my gosh. Here I am, the American, the rude American.
Sorry. That's very rude of me to point this out. But just for the record, I'm doing relatively okay. So thanks for...
Yes.
I know you're very kind and sweet. I'm sure you would have asked me if I wasn't being so awkward and rude.
This actually isn't Carson. This is Daniel talking to you, remember? This is all a ruse.
Did have a little mix-up. I was texting what I thought was Dan the other day, and it was you. You were like, hey, it's Carson. I'm like, what? It threw me off. Do you guys often do this, trick people?
No, I was working on... On Daniel's computer, I was using the program Illustrator and making some edits. So your name popped up, and I was like, "Oh, Fish and I will be speaking soon. I'll just introduce myself and say that plan works great." Then we had a little fun with you. I don't think you know actually, but the end of that conversation was also me.
What was that? What happened at the end?
You just started responding to me. As if I were Daniel.
Oh, I see.
After we had already sort of like, I think you thought that it was over. Anyways, we were having too much.
Yeah, there's a lot.
And then we were both, then he was sitting on his phone and I was on his computer and we were both texting you. It was insane.
So which one of you made the Microsoft joke?
That was Daniel.
Okay, see,
that was good.
It's very treacherous to text Dan now. I never know who's going to be responding. It could be anyone. But anyway, it was fun. It was nice. I thought about it in retrospect. I'm like, do they think I'm actually upset about this? You didn't think I was actually upset. I didn't care. I just thought it was funny.
Well, I just, like, at a certain point, I was like, oh, I don't really know Vish. And I'm just, like, engaging with him here and, like, playing with him. And maybe he finds that really annoying.
No, it wasn't annoying. It's just I made a joke. You said... as long as you said we were talking about the setup, right? And then you said I'll be at my computer, and as long as I'm near a window, I think you said, or windows,
yes,
it'll be great. And I said, does your computer have windows or something like that because of the program? And then you said, is that a joke? And I was like, does she not know what Windows is? Maybe she's an Apple person. Then I got really like, I was like, this is awkward now. I feel like I tried to make a lame dad joke and then she shot me down and now I don't know what to think. So I couldn't tell. All of it was just a lot of...
And then Daniel chimed in.
Then he said...
It was all in great fun.
Yeah, Dan's callback was that Windows joke made me Microsoft, which I thought was funny. And
that was very
it was good. All of it was very good. I'm glad we were talking about this text thread. Nevertheless, it is very...
Well, it's all that to say that I apologize for not asking you how you were doing, but I was caught up in our conversation before... Mm-hmm. I think I had asked you how you were doing.
That's true, you did.
Perhaps.
You did, yeah.
So, I came across as the rude American, but I did not mean
it's
to.
It's just a little gag I try to... I'm not looking to pounce on Americans for not asking how I am, but it does seem to happen more than with Canadians. Although I have called out Canadians as well. And who am I? I'm very rude. Like, look how rude this has started. It's just very rude to point out all these things. So it's just like a hypocritical... thing I do, I guess. But I do honestly hope you're doing okay. Where in the world are you today?
I am in the basement of the Romano family home. Daniel's folks are out of town and it's quite cold here. So we are staying at their place where they have central air and also taking it upon ourselves to shovel the driveway.
Oh, nice.
While they're out of town. So we're here for a couple of days. And we've done that twice now, which is kind of fun. I mean, the other night, Daniel's brother Ian and his girlfriend Shannon came over, and so it's been sort of this funny little family gathering space where music is happening. Shannon's over now. She's scanning some of her art, and anyways, It's kind of a nice little home base for a minute.
First of all, I've been to that home mm-hmm. at least once, and I recall it being a very lovely home. At the time that I visited, Dan had a full-fledged studio in the basement. I see some sort of PA speaker-looking things behind you there. So is it still active as a band room or recording space?
It is. Recently, during the past year, they have busted out this wall that was, you can see the mm-hmm, beam mm-hmm. here. There was a wall there. So this was kind of more like a control room, and then there was like a live room. But they've busted it out, so it's much more open now. And in fact, at one point last year, we did a little sort of impromptu show for Joni's birthday for Daniel and Ian's mom, and the outfit and I played in here. And Kenny, the sound engineer, was here with us. It was like a party, but it turned into a show. And so he ran sound, and we got some cool lights going and played a show in the basement. But yeah. So there's some instruments around, and there's space down here, which is nice.
Nice. That's great, and it's a little home away from home. Oh, the other thing I was going to ask about, because you mentioned Ian and Shannon, and I don't know the whole story of the kind of place you guys normally live. Is it a bit of a communal living situation? Like, does Ian live there as well?
He doesn't, but live now just down the road.
Right.
Yeah. So we're all, like, the outfit crew is kind of all within, you know, arm's length, kind of.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that's really nice, especially for me, somebody who's, I don't feel so now, but a bit of an outsider, and coming into this group and finding, like, quite a welcoming little community here, especially, like, to be introduced to this, my new home, away from home during such a time as we're living in now, which is bizarre, you know. Oh, let me take you here, or I want you to meet these people, and that's just not really happening these days. So
yeah.
So it's been really nice to have this pretty tight knit but really welcoming close community here of friends and fellow creators.
Yeah.
So
That's great. Now, we, again, awkwardly alluded to the fact that you are American. And again, I'd like to apologize for how I brought that to the table. But let's dig into that a little bit on two levels. One, can you talk about where you're actually from mm-hmm. and where you spent most of your time living before you moved to Canada? And also, within that, how long have you been in Canada? Those are my two questions. Can you speak to those?
Yeah. So I'm from Texas. I'm from Austin, so Central Texas. And that's where I've lived my whole life. I spent about a semester and a half in Arkansas, where briefly in college, but never called anywhere else my home. Although the past probably 5 years or so, I've spent almost more time than not on the road. But yes, when I am home, it's always been Austin. And so, let's see, I moved with Daniel here in September of 2020. We arrived.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So the pandemic, everything was in full swing. Okay.
Yeah. So it was an interesting time to be sort of relocating, but even before that, crossing a border.
Yeah.
That, you know, so it's been interesting, but also really, like, the perspective of this weird time that we're in and with the pandemic and everything, it's like, it's interesting. My family is all still in Texas. My dad and my grandfather and my brother in Austin, and my mother in far west Texas. Out in the desert, and then us being here for the most part the past 2 years. We've gone back and forth a couple times, but it's especially in this climate, it's like get to where you're going and then kind of stay put for a while just because things at the border are strange. But yeah, so it's been interesting to have this perspective just sort of as people figure out how to navigate the pandemic and, you know, the differences in climates here and there. And then, you know, being there for a while, how you just sort of see things from there. Anyways, it's quite interesting.
I mean, you're alluding to climates, and I can only assume you kind of mean literally, like, you know, it's just a different, the winter here is harder, in Canada is harder than...
I mean, literally, but also figuratively.
I was going to say, like, know, I yeah. mean, what kind of, like, I know the Texans I know who are from, like, who are from Texas or leave Texas, it's always in their heart. They keep it close. Anytime I've spent in Texas has been kind of lovely, if not a little overwhelming. But I think with Governor Greg Abbott and Senator Ted Cruz, and then on the other side, you got Beto O'Rourke. I think socio-politically, like, it's a very fraught place. I imagine you have feelings on this. I know.
I mean, it's vast, you know, so there are lots of different kinds of people. Like, physically, the landscape is very different. And also, you know, the mentalities in those places are different. And so, yeah, it's kind of a strange thing to be from a place that people sort of associate this, like, pride. I mean, there's a bit of that with wherever you come from, I think. But definitely Texas, I think, has the rap of being, like, you know, you've got, like, Texas pride.
And bravado. Don't mess with Texas.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And so there's that, which is a funny thing to sort of blanket over such a huge state, you know, because you're covering a lot of ground there, or you're attempting to. And, you know, I'm from Texas, but I grew up in Austin, you know, which is a very different.
Austin, Denton, like, the places I can think of were very, like, kind of liberal arts, whatever you want to call it, like, just pretty good vibes. But then you hear of these other places and you're like, oh, it sounds totally pretty rough or whatever. I mean, that's also just, like, me living in a vacuum, or me having a bias towards certain milieus, if you will. Like,
sure.
So,
well, Austin itself is that way, you know, in more ways than one, you know, as far as, like, how people think of things politically, but also, you know, socially. And I'm really, really grateful to have grown up in that city with the family that I grew up in and, you know, sort of the perspective of that liberal-leaning community.
Yeah.
At the same time, it took getting out on the road and going to these little teeny tiny Texas towns in the beginning, and then also beyond the state, obviously, itself and to the rest of the world, but traveling to realize what I really thought about the city. And in some ways, you know, how, like, it likes to think of itself as being very progressive, and in a lot of ways it is, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like many of those sort of bigger Texas cities, although they are quite diverse, they're incredibly segregated, and, you know, the liberal attitude, you are amongst other liberals in this pocket of the city, and so you can feel a certain way and vote a certain way politically, but not necessarily ever interact with those people who are not like you.
Yeah.
Even if you say that you relate to them is not the right word, but that you want to represent people, you know, and it's like, well, but what? Who are you actually representing? Like, do you, you know, and it's just, it comes with the territory, I think, but definitely getting that perspective of being outside and then coming back has been crucial.
It's all very interesting to hear this from you, because you've talked about how being in Ontario and Canada, you value the fact that you're part of a community. I'm going to guess you were part of a similar community in Austin. But, like, when we're talking about Texas, like, it's called the Lone Star State, and there's some lonerism there. Like, you're also talking about, like, how people are kind of galvanized but kind of isolated. And, like, when I think of the Lone Star State, and I'm not trying to put too heavy a hand on that little slogan or nickname whatever.
I mean,
but like, last winter, and I don't know what's going on this winter, but I think it's happening again, the world learned that Texas does not operate on the same grid.
It does not.
As the rest of the country that you live in or lived in. So then we're like, oh, it really is this loner, like, is it going to secede? Like, why would it be off the grid?
And you, can we support ourselves? You know, like
yeah,
all these people who are gung-ho
weird.
About that.
Yeah.
It's a strange sort of contradiction of itself in a way, you know. And yes, there is something sort of similar happening right now as it did last winter. You know, my mom's out in Alpine, Texas, which is near Big Bend, which is the big park out there. So she's pretty much out in the desert, but it's 9 degrees there, which it's 10 degrees warmer here.
Oh,
it's
I see.
Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Than it is in Texas right now, which is bizarre. And last year that was devastating and it was brutal.
Yeah.
She's not lost power yet, which is good. And you know, she, remembering last year, bought a little camp stove in case she did. So, you know, but it's like,
it's so bizarre. Isn't Texas like one of the richest states in the union? Like, should it, why is it like and I don't mean to misspeak, but that's like third worldish like behavior,
that you
could lose power during a winter. So, anyway, I mean, we're not going to resolve Texas, you and I, today, nor is it our responsibility,
Come
but it is odd. But where I'm coming from by asking some of these questions is I wonder how Texas informs you as an artist, because in listening to the two records I know of yours are Carousel and this beautiful new one, Still Life, and the typical or stereotypical thing for someone like me maybe to think is, yeah, I can hear the Texas there. I can hear the country and folk stuff that we associate with Texas.
Sure.
But so I'm just wondering, on an aesthetic level, on a tonal level, in terms of you as a songwriter, and by the way, like when I hear the song Hawks Don't Share, I think about Texas and I think about what that means as an American to say Hawks Don't Share. But anyway, my point is this. Can you talk a little bit about how Texas informs you and your aesthetic? It's obviously a huge part of you. You're from there. But do you feel like the tradition of Texas, if you will, informing your work?
I guess in a way. Absolutely. You're correct. I mean, every little thing I think is informing me, and, you know, whether I pick up on it or not. But absolutely, I think the landscape wherever I am has been informative of the stuff that I'm writing. I want to say maybe that, like, as a kid growing up in Austin, which is a relatively family-friendly town, or at least was when I was growing up, like, my folks were not musicians, but they were in the beer business. And
the beer business?
Yeah, yeah.
Specifically in what regard?
Distributorship.
Oh, distributing. Okay.
So
they weren't making beer in the basement.
Actually, yes. When I was born, my dad and his brother and my mom and they ran their own little brewery, which I think was just ahead of its time. This was
all the craft
like
brewing,
1992.
There's all that going on now. Wow.
Right, exactly. But just prior to that, they were involved with this distributorship, and so it was, you know, my dad or other people they worked with going to these bars in Texas, in Austin, which is, you know, the live music capital of the world, and most bars are also venues to a certain extent. And of course, during South by, any flat surface becomes a music venue. And
I don't want to lose this thread and go on a tangent, but I did attend one. I've only ever attended one South by Southwest, and I can't say that I liked it. Do you like it?
Oh, yeah, it's insane.
Do people like it? The locals like it? I can't tell. It's obviously a big influx.
I mean, it's one of those things that's like, it's just chaos, really.
Yeah. Okay.
That's okay. My birthday falls during South by, which is like also kind of spring break. And now they've extended it, you know, it's 2 weeks now. But growing up, it was always like, oh, let's leave. Let's go out of town.
Let's leave
the city, you know.
And you are a music fan. So that says something.
Yeah.
Like one of the world's biggest music festivals starts up in your hometown and you're like, we got to split.
Let's get out of here.
Interesting.
No, I remember. I mean, it's just hellacious trying to like get through the city, let alone park, unload, you know, and then get to the next 8 gigs you have in that one day or whatever. But yeah, it's insane. I mean, I remember having to go downtown to do some sort of registry thing at some point during a South By, and somebody, I was like crossing the Interstate 35 runs right through the middle of town. Mm-hmm. And I think I had even walked because it was just going to be too crazy to drive and try to park somewhere at the convention center to do this registry. But somebody sort of pulled up alongside the road and they were like, excuse me, can you tell me where the South by Southwest is? And I was just like, oh no, you poor thing. I was like, you're in it, man. And you're not getting out.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's insanity.
Yeah.
But it also is, you know, obviously, I mean, working in service industry too, during that time, it's just like, okay, this is going to be crazy and it's going to be hell and we're going
right.
to try to make as much money as we can.
Yeah, exactly.
Which,
yeah.
which you, if you're playing or if you're involved in South By, you want to be on the service industry side, not so much the music side, because you won't make any money playing music during South By, but, you know, serving people hot dogs, you can.
Have you yourself performed at South By Southwest?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Many times. So, but yeah, okay. It's wild. Yeah. But anyways, yeah. back yeah. to what we were talking about, which is sort of how Texas has informed me.
Yeah.
What I was saying was that, like, I guess my introduction to music and the scene before even beginning to write and play myself was through my folks and their friends. And it was not necessarily even like about the music, you know, but as a young kid going to and from these bars in the beer truck or what, you know, and meeting these people and then having musicians show up, you know, in the backyard and having hangs or whatever, and meeting these different people as I was growing up, lots of characters, and then going to see live music with my parents. Because it was a town that had that every night of the week, you know, was, you know, it led to meeting people once I had, you know, picked up a guitar and was playing some shows early on. And my folks would come out and it would be like, oh, they know the bartender. Like, and they're like, oh, we used to come here all the time, you know. And that eventually actually led them back into the scene and away, and they ended up opening their own bars. So my introduction to that was through this slew of characters that I kind of grew up around, but not being involved with musically yet. But my folks were fans of music, you know, and being a Texas kid, like, you know, you've got like Towns and Guy Clark and those sort of, that sort of storytelling. And I love that and appreciate it, but I never wrote like that, I didn't feel. My mom is a writer. She writes short fiction and poetry.
Oh.
So I think as a writer, you gravitate to things like that. But that's very much like there's this narrative storytelling in a lot of that sort of singer-songwriter style. And I don't know if it's because I felt like I wasn't good at it or if it was just not the kind of thing I wanted to do, but I felt more inclined towards the poetry of it than and the scenery of it, the landscape of it, than that narrative, that sort of timeline that happens in a lot of those songs, you know, where there's a character and they go through these things. I was more intrigued by the scene itself.
The language, not necessarily the story, like the wordplay, if you will. Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, I started reading stuff like Cormac McCarthy and, you know, that is poetry. I mean, there are epic tales in those books, but the way that he talks about landscape is incredibly moving to me.
Well,
and it creates that you feel that.
Well, and
that thing.
The poetry thing with Cormac McCarthy resonates with me because it's also the way it's framed. There's no punctuation, there's no upper lower case. It is a string of language and words, and when you first pick up a Cormac McCarthy novel like that, you have to attune to that.
Yeah.
You have to be like, "Oh, this is a totally different way of that I'm used to in terms of reading a narrative story. It's just
right.
a bundle of words, but they cohere. If you're lucky, you get so immersed in it and you can't put it down.
I think that's exactly how you are able to immerse yourself in it, is you get the things around the very loose, sometimes narrative, start to, you know, the painting, you can see it. You can see it and you're in it, and then you sort of give yourself to it. It's interesting. This is sort of a random thought, but I listened to this George Saunders.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know him?
I know of George Saunders. Yeah, yeah.
And I think it was Lincoln and the Bardo is a book of his. I listened to that book with my manager, Tim, on this tour I did in the UK, where it was just the two of us, like, driving on the wrong side of the road and in the gray and cold.
It is the right side of the world there. Let's be
clear.
Look,
I'm a Texan, and I'm just going to say that's not right.
No, I think it's the wrong side of the road, too. You and I know it's the wrong side of the road, but just for my listeners in the UK, we don't want them to think we think they don't know what
they're
doing. I
only say that because it was disorienting.
No, it is absolutely.
Which leads me to this book, which has, like, so many different narrators, and we listened to it, right? And so that helped a little bit because it's different voices. But it's still, like, totally bizarre, and you don't know what's going on for a good long while, and sometimes even throughout it. But it's captivating, and you do have to just put your hands up and give yourself to it. And then all of a sudden you fall in, you know, and you're in step with it. But
you encounter, we were talking about Cormac McCarthy, and we were talking about language and words, as opposed to necessarily there being a linear structure to a narrative and songwriting.
Right.
All I was going to add to that is, like, you mentioned George Saunders, you mentioned Cormac McCarthy. You encounter these figures in these lives where they do something in a convention, and they do it in a way you're like, why would anyone have done this differently? Like, I don't why doesn't everyone do things like this? Like, that's what I get from people like that. And then as you read people like those two figures, and I'm not as familiar with George Saunders, I should say that. But
and
when you
me neither, but
okay.
Yeah.
When I read Cormac McCarthy and then you see his influence on others, I'll pick up a book by a Canadian writer who does the exact same thing.
Yeah.
And obviously inspired by Cormac, but it also works. Like, it doesn't seem like a knockoff. You're like, oh, well, maybe we don't need all that mediation, if you will, of language convention. So,
well, I think, you know, people, if there's an intent to play with the form, that's curious itself, you know, and that can be engaging, you know, and it's like, I think a ripoff would be to just, like, fall back on that.
Yeah, yeah.
But for someone to incorporate that, being influenced by this other person, is immediately interesting.
Yeah.
It's compelling, you know.
And you're from what I can tell, you're a scene setter. Like, when you, the song Fingernail Moon, like, I'm outside and I'm looking at that moon. So I feel like you have those, that vivid aesthetic where I feel like your songs transport me to their universe. And I think that comes from what you're saying, immersing yourself in other writers who do that sort of thing, but also finding your own voice. So I'm just saying.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
I think that I have always thought of myself more as a lyricist from that perspective, as opposed to, like, a narrative storyteller. But creating that world, you know, it's so crucial to being able to communicate then the small things that you are telling.
Yeah.
And I think that with this album that I just made with Daniel, he was such an integral part to that, because I am a student always, but I think more so right now with music than I have allowed myself in the past. So working with Daniel, I felt like I was enabled to use these musical tools that we were both, you know, had at our fingertips in order to help me create this scene in a more vivid way than I have been able to in the past. And I think so much of that has to do with Daniel, and also just being in the place that I am now as a student and listening in a certain way to things, so that I am hearing the thing that's making me feel that way. Because I feel like I've always been a very, like, I'm sensitive. And I feel like I can pick up on things and I feel them intensely.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I've ever been able to, like, the whole package deliver that. And I'm exercising that right now, which is really exciting with my listening and also with my playing. And then obviously the two of us making this record essentially alone, putting those things, you know, to tape for Pro Tools.
I appreciate what you're saying. And I want to actually, and I appreciate that Daniel has been a key figure in your artistic life in recent yeah. years. It sounds like you're saying he's brought something out of you and brought your imagination closer to tape, which I totally appreciate. But I wonder if this is a worthwhile time to distinguish between your last record that I'm aware of, Carousel, which came out in 2018, and where you were at then,
mm-hmm.
and that sound as it relates to Still Life, because I see a huge difference there. I hear the Daniel Romano's outfit aesthetic a little more clearly in Still Life, obviously, and that's for obvious reasons. But what to you is the distinction artistically as a whole between these two records? Do you feel like there's other aspects of your voice and expression that have been heightened in recent years?
Well, I think something that's worth talking about or mentioning at least is that Carousel was a bit of a almost like a retrospective. I was sort of reimagining songs that I had recorded initially in Austin. And this was years later, and it was sort of a collection of songs that I had been playing out in this bar scene with lots of different bands, or, you know, scenarios of bands for me in order to put my music in the world. And so that was kind of a strange exercise to look back on those songs and re-record them. And there was like baggage with it. I felt like I was revisiting the stuff that I needed to revisit for a certain reason. You know, I needed to like revisit it so that I could move on. And so a lot of that was years in the making. You know what I mean? And,
yeah, yeah.
And with Still Life, everything seemed really immediate.
Yeah.
I mean,
and current probably.
Current. I mean, there are a couple of songs that I had been carrying for a while that for whatever reason I hadn't recorded or I'd played with recording and it wasn't the right time or whatever. But for the most part, these songs were written within the same year that they were recorded, you know, which was new for me in that way. It was very immediate. And I think that comes across. I mean, I think that there's an urgency in the music and in the lyrics that is potent, I would like to say. I hope.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think you're kind of getting to the notion that I talk about this with people sometimes, that there's so much art where the creator is learning in public.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you're making a record for the first time and you've never done it before. And
I
then
mean,
you're presenting it yeah. to people and they have to be like, I guess this is who this person is. And then within a couple of years, you're like, no, I've learned so much from that experience. And now the next thing's going to be, it could be radically different. I mean, we both know Dan has gone, if you examine his catalog, for example,
yeah.
he's a real exemplary artist for this line of discussion, I think, because it's just been radically different as he's gone on. And I assume in your own way, you feel like that last previous record is radically different from this one. It was a whole other thing.
Yeah.
But they're both
yeah,
sort of
I mean,
circulating. And yeah, so it's interesting.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting how we relate to works that feel like they're a part of our past. Even if not much time has passed.
As we're speaking, it's Bandcamp Friday, and I just, on a whim, someone randomly brought up the fact that I played in a band with a relatively well-known journalist in Canada. And I said, oh, yeah, someone from Michigan. And I said, oh, yeah, yeah, I can get you those records. So I built a Bandcamp page, and it's Bandcamp Fridays we're speaking. So I was like, you know what?
Right.
Hey, guys, I'm just going to share it. I don't care. Like, it's some of it I'm like, ugh. Why did we do that? But some of it I'm like, it's fine. It's good. It was just what it was. And what am I supposed to do? It was buried, but we've unearthed it. Like, it was only on CD compilations or a CD. Like, there was
sure.
no. And so there's part of me that's like, it's a sign of maturity to let go. Like, yeah, some of that I'm proud of. Some of it I'm not. I've moved on with my life. I'm not going to hide this from anyone. I'm not saying that you're doing that, but it must be the artistic mind has to do that. Compartmentalize its past.
Absolutely.
Yeah. 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 So.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting how we develop and how we grow and that, you know, sort of every little thing is influencing that in a way. And I feel like there are a couple of things that I would like to say in regard to that. Like the process with Still Life, like I said, it all felt pretty immediate, especially because of the writing of the songs and then the recording of them happened, you know, pretty much within a year of each other, which can seem like a long time if you're hanging out with Daniel, but this was, you know, in like normal time, not Daniel time. Yeah. But for me, that was quick, or at least it felt like that. But then on top of that, and this is the weird thing about this time and me relating that to this record and sort of the energy that it embodies is like over the past 2 years, my life has changed dramatically.
Yeah.
This pandemic happened. So my life shifted immediately when I was called home from tour in Spain and I just left in the middle of a run and flew home and went immediately into a quarantine because I'd been kissing Spaniards on both cheeks and stuff, you know, and it was like, oh my God, okay, got to get home. And then I was home in this is strange time that everyone was subjected to. And then in the midst of that, I got married and I have a life partner now, which is a huge deal and a different way of orienting yourself with the world, and then moving, you know, I definitely still call Austin and call Texas my home, but moving to a different country.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just across the border, but it's been a wild time. And so then to carry these songs that I wrote sort of in a frenzy when I had these short little moments at home during a busy tour schedule, to then having this strange pause in your normal schedule that becomes very prolonged, and then to pick everything up and bring it here and say, okay, let's make a record with all this other stuff happening, and I'm growing and I'm learning and I'm experiencing things in a new way, thinking about music or the world or myself in a different way. It was like double speed but also totally slowed down in this bizarre way that, I mean, we were talking about a vacuum before, but I kind of like, it was kind of this strange limbo, like Bardo sort of like hanging moment of like looking at, well, specifically with these songs, like they carried with them certain things and they were written, you know, in my little house in Austin between tours. And then I brought them here. And whatever they were carrying in this new context either fell away or was, you know, much more defined. And that was very helpful.
Yeah.
to take myself and these tunes out of their, you know, initial perspective or surroundings and address them here. It was a very good exercise for me. And it felt, I mean, I had made a handful of demos with the crew that I was touring with in Austin or out of Austin with these songs, a couple of them. And I showed those to Daniel. And it was almost to the point where, like, some of the stuff was, like, really raw. It was just, like, a guitar and my voice. Some of the stuff was more fleshed out. But it was something that I was, like, do I want to use this? Like, do I want to release something like this? That I mean, I could sort of piece this thing together, and it would be an interesting thing. And then we came here, and, I mean, I think you're familiar a bit with how Daniel works, and... Mm-hmm. He likes to pick something up and run with it, you know? And so we decided, no, let's just set up the drums in the living room and make this record. So it was interesting. I think I jumped all around there, and I apologize, but...
No, it's fine. I'm trying... The only thing I'm trying to land on is you said you wrote most of these songs in your house in Austin. Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
All of them except, I mean, maybe one or two began on a tour somewhere in an attic in Sweden or something. But I mean, the real writing of the songs happened, yeah, in my house in Austin.
And so what time frame were most of these written? Like, do you remember the years or the span of time?
Yeah, it would have been like late 2019.
Okay, so prior to... It's just fascinating to me because I hear in the songs, you know, a recognition that things are changing for you.
Yeah.
I hear emergent love. I hear relationships ending. When I hear the song Still Life, and which is, you know, the motif of the record, if you will, just because that's how it's framed as the title. But that's an interesting concept in 2022 because to my limited knowledge, it alludes to a form of visual art, if you will, and art generally. And yet here we all are in this period of lockdown and isolation where in your field in particular, as a touring musician, your life is still. So again, this is too English, a rudimentary English essay maybe at the moment, but.
No, I mean, that's, I appreciate that because I feel like that's how I work. And it's strange how I think, and that I think that's why I went into the whole sort of story of this, where they were written, how they were written, how they were recorded, when they were recorded, and having it all be within this year, this 1 year, you know, from late 2019 to late 2020. It's weird because I think, but at least a couple of people have asked me, like, oh, was this, you know, these songs were written during the pandemic, you know? And they weren't. They were written right before that. And it's just interesting how things come to be and, you know, turn into, like, I mean, I do feel like they were written at a time when I was having to, strangely enough, with my hectic schedule, slow down because I was completely overwhelmed with this or that or whatever. And it was time to really try to put things in focus and address what I had in front of me. And like, okay, you have this perspective and what will you do with it? How will you move forward? And can you do so with intention? And the thing is I think that the songs themselves and the energy of the record itself doesn't resolve that, you know? And in that way, the like urgency of the album, it's very much in turmoil still, you know, I think the entirety of it. But as somebody who is now looking at it as something that I did like in the past, like not the distant past, but like it's something that's finished. It embodies just that. And the fact that it is at all is proof that I did move forward with intention. But so it's a weird like exercise just that it exists, at least for me as a person who's, I don't know if that sounds insane, but I mean, it's quite simple really, but maybe it just sounds like not profound, but it's like really is simple.
Yeah, you sound like someone who ruminates on ideas maybe a bit more than in this case.
I should.
No, I wasn't going to say that at all. Your primary collaborator, like you said, is someone who's like, let's just do this. And
right.
I've had numerous conversations with Dan about some of the records he's made, and it almost always comes down to, well, the drums were set up and mic'd.
Yeah.
So why the hell wouldn't we just, why wouldn't I just, you know, get a bunch of songs down? And yeah. So that is a very, I can see how that would be alien to someone who's used to thinking a lot about what a session means or how a song is going to come across, like for posterity or whatever. Like some of us sure. get the recording studio or the recording process can be daunting because you have a sense of the history you're making for yourself. As mm-hmm. I alluded to earlier, like I put out a bunch of a band I was yeah. in. Some of it I can stand by. Some of it I'm like, that's a little corny, but what are you going to do? But like I think everyone who goes into a studio and hears we're rolling knows what's going on and knows what they're doing. And I can see you as someone who's still, I think I would argue, maybe relatively new to the recording process even.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To have someone just say, let's just do it. I can see how you would be a little jarred because you're someone who spends, I can tell by your lyrics that you spend a lot of time thinking about what you're going to do and what you're trying to say. And I when I hear this record, like I say, I hear like a broken, distorted guitars and stuff like that. Stuff I don't know yeah. that you've totally explored in your work before. Like it was a different sound. All of it was just different. And yeah. that's my read of it. And so you're like, the approach was different. The sound is different. But I fit. My voice fits in this. So, and my aesthetic fits in this.
It just made...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, sorry, I don't mean to cut you off.
You should. I've been rambling for about 5 minutes on this line of thought. Sorry.
Well, no. I mean, that's the thing is like when it is argued that this is new and different, it's like, yeah, it is. But like, if I tell you this thing, it makes perfect sense. It's exactly yeah. what, of course, would have happened. And like, it's interesting because, you know, we were talking about Daniel's recording process, yeah. process in general, artistic yeah. process. And it was that way. But also, I mean, remember that we're setting up in our living room and it's the two of us and we're on our own time. So in that way, it was like at any point we could say, we need to walk away from this for a minute, you know, or two, there's not a live band. It's the two of us building these tracks, you know, piece by piece, because it's only the two of us,
right.
you know, and for the most part, it's, you know, Daniel playing drums, Daniel playing bass. And, you know, so it's like we build out. And so we like our limitations really allowed us actually a lot of experimentation, at least for me, as someone who was new to a lot of this stuff, you know, doing multiple vocal tracks or auxiliary percussion and like throwing extra guitars on stuff. You know, it was like that stuff was new to me, and it was something that we could experiment with. Having the drum set up in the living room meant that like if Daniel approached a song a certain way and he could do anything and it would be like, oh, whoa, that's it. Or I could be like, no, that's really not, that's not going to work. That's yeah. not what I'm like. It's yeah. not going to be that way. And it's like, okay, here we go. Like switch gears
yeah.
and
try something else. Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, it was funny how you would think that maybe it would be like intense or jarring because Daniel does work a certain way, and to have somebody else involved in that process, I think even for him sometimes is the challenge. But it was, we also had the, you know, we did it in our living room, so we allowed ourselves space with things, and you know, that was really special.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, yeah, it was an interesting thing because we hadn't worked together musically before, you know. So it was kind of like just sort of seeing how each other would react to the way that we were reacting to the songs themselves, you know?
Yeah.
And I felt like it was very natural and organic. And I, like I said, the way that I'm listening now, I think I've developed, like my ear is developing, and I'm able to pinpoint the things that I'm hearing or the things that I want to hear better than I have before, just because I'm learning it. And so it is I'm like, oh, that is exactly, this is what I want it to be. Or this is, yes, that's it. Or no, or what about this? You know,
for what it's worth, I think it's a really wondrous union. And this record, Still Life, is great. I mean, as a fan of Dan's and now as a fan of yours, like, it's perfect. Like, you've done a fantastic job together. So I want to commend you on that. Before we, I don't want to hit this too hard, but I do want to, I alluded to Hawkstone Share earlier.
Yeah.
And I just am curious about that because it sounds like something you'd hear like Attenborough say in like a Planet Earth documentary. Of course, Hawkstone Share. Yeah, I can't do the accent. But my point is this. That's an interesting sentiment. And I know that there's some metaphorical aspect to it. What inspired that song and that turn of phrase?
I will tell you. I hope it doesn't make you think less of me.
Okay.
Well, first of all, I've always been a hawk person. I think my dad's a hawk person.
Hawks are cool. I like hawks.
I'm that person in the van who's like, oh, what? There's a hawk.
Yeah.
But, oh, there he is. Anyways, Hawks Don't Share, or actually Hawks Do Not Share, is the title of a chapter in A Movable Feast by Ernest Hemingway.
Yes. Okay.
And It's that chapter specifically is about Zelda and F. Scott Fitzgerald and their tumultuous relationship, specifically creatively, like that there was lots of sabotage involved and jealousy. And that is actually a song that I'd been carrying for a while. I wrote that song, actually began writing that song years ago, finished it probably a couple years ago. And then, yeah, we recorded it for this, but yeah, that was when I read that. It was unfortunately something that I related to, which is you know, it's beautiful and interesting. And I think, you know, we create our reality to a huge extent. And like to make that song the way that it is, record the song the way that it is heard now on this record with Daniel as a creative partner and a life partner, and then to make an accompanying music video with all of these other creatives that are a part of my new community is a very important thing to me. You know, it's like that song was spawned from, you know, just this bizarre sort of creative jealousy, and then became the catalyst for like these beautiful connections and this like collaborative piece on many levels, the song itself, but also the video that I made with the outfit. And anyways, yeah, it's just funny. It's like the songs sounding like they were written in the pandemic, and they embody so much of the things that I think a lot of us are relating to these days. And it's just like, I'm realizing through this whole process, you know, developing my ear, my eye visually, that, you know, it's the things that we focus on are the things that influence how we go about our day to day, you know, and it's how we position ourselves within that and how we choose to approach something that's going to determine the way we feel and the things that happen around us.
I mean, I've come across in my studies and in my conversations with people like you and who make other things, like the lazy thing is to suggest that there's a certain prescience in art. But what I'm dialing into is that I think it's not simply prescience. It's that prescience suggests that something hasn't happened yet, I guess. These soothsayers knew what was going to happen. But what I'm trying to dial into is I think that stuff, that you're singing about that everyone is experiencing during a pandemic that you wrote before a pandemic, that means it was already there.
I mean, that's the thing.
The artistic mind is tapping into stuff that the rest of us are missing. And that's, I think, one of the reasons we value art, is because most artists are stopping to notice something and observe something and convey something about it that the rest of us maybe don't have time for. And then when something like a pandemic happens...
Or don't notice.
Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Because I think everybody in their own way is doing that. You know, that's why you get these beautiful, dark, quiet films that are about everyday people that you're like, whoa, with that framing, that is profound.
Yeah.
And that's just somebody's... the mundanity of... You know, it's like that's real, and I think it's just taking the time to notice those things. And sometimes there are things that you don't want to take too much time to note, or you know, you want to pay attention to it and address it, but not, you know, sink into it.
There's some hard truths in noticing things. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to say again that I appreciate you and I appreciate this record, and it's lovely. And
I hope
people spend time with the words as much as the sounds, and singing too. Like I feel like we've both delved in and scratched the surface, but I hope you're feeling good about what we've conveyed about this work and your work. And if you're not,
I do.
Okay, just making sure. I like to check in at the end. I need a report card before the end of a conversation for some reason.
I really appreciate that.
We're in a period of stillness, I think, as we're speaking, two things. The record came out on February 25th. Tours have been scheduled and canceled and all those sorts of things. Can you in some way, as we're speaking, Carson, give us a sense of your future plans, either when it comes to touring or other singles or videos or activities we should be looking out for? Can you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, as you said, there have been tours scheduled and rescheduled. So, I mean, the rest of 2022 is basically booked up. I'll be busy playing if things go as I hope they do and continue to get better. I plan to be on the road. But also, I mean, like we talked about, this record was written pretty much in 2019, and I've done a lot of writing since then.
Oh, nice.
And so I'll have another record in the works, along with, you know, likely some visual representations of that work. And what else? I don't know. I plan to stay busy. I mean, I've been keeping that way so far. I'm really missing playing and performing.
Yeah.
I did not realize how much that meant to me.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
In terms of,
I look forward to that.
I appreciate that. In terms of, I know it's very young in terms of writing new songs, but do you imagine you'll approach it the same way with you and Dan figuring things out?
Yeah. I mean, in fact, we've played around here and there. We built a studio, so we have this space that we can be creative in, which is incredible. And so we've already begun playing around with some of the tunes. And yeah, I imagine things will happen along similar lines.
Yeah.
But surely it will be different and in many, many ways.
Yeah. And it should be noted, and we haven't talked about it, but you're now also a member of The Outfit, Dan's band.
Yeah.
So you're really joined at the hip creatively and familiarly. You're doing everything together. That's great.
Yeah, it's been incredible. And I'm learning a lot. What an honor to be working alongside Daniel and the rest of his band. The Outfit are all wonderful, wonderful musicians and creators and people. And I mean, it's very exciting for me. I've never really been a part of a group like that, and well, at all. And so, yeah, it's been really, really great work for me to exercise those other parts of my creative side that's not just me putting something, pen to paper or whatever, you know. But being involved with someone else's vision and sound,
it's lovely for me to hear that you found both like family and community in Canada. That's great.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, that's great.
Yeah.
Now, if people want to learn more about you or follow you on the their telephones, on their computers, those sorts of things, where would you like to send them?
I guess I would send people to, I have a website. I don't know if people go to websites anymore, but I've
people always say this, but isn't everything just still a website? Isn't Instagram basically a website? What's the difference?
I guess
they're all websites.
Right. You're right.
All your stuff is at your website, which is great, but then you have all these other websites.
They're my websites.
So I think they're all, sorry, I don't mean to go on a rant, but everyone keeps saying this, like, I have a website, but I'm a little sheepish because everyone uses, I'm sheepish because everyone uses the social media, but they're all websites. Come on.
Yes. Well, the one website, the www dot whatever, Carson McCone Music, I think is what it is. I don't know. Like, it's weird navigating, like, Instagram, Facebook. I hardly really know how to do that anymore, but I have a really friendly manager who helps me do that. But, like, Instagram is, like, what does it even do anymore? I don't know how to, like, do people even see that stuff? I don't know. But so anyways, like, this website, www, I don't know. I feel like, I mean, you can only do so much on Squarespace, and I'm not very tech savvy, but I do feel like it's been a cool way for me to interact with at least like the visual side of things. I have like, I have it laid out a certain way. I've been making a lot of visual art and those things are incorporated in the layout. And also there's a page specifically for that. So anyways, I would encourage people to check that out if they're at all interested in what I'm doing.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then find you on the other things.
And like, and of course, Instagram, I usually like, I mean, that's news and I post art on there as well. So that's definitely a good way, but yeah.
I like your Instagram for what it's worth. So
hey,
good job on that. And then for people interested in picking up a copy of Still Life, either go to your local record store.
Absolutely.
Hopefully. Or visit mergerecords.com.
Yes.
And you can find more info about Carson and her work there. Carson, if we can go out on a song from Still Life, I know people have gotten used to it already because it's been out, but can you pick something? And if so, can you tell us why you chose it?
Absolutely. Spoil on the Vine is the last track on side one of the record. And it's actually the first song that I made a video for. And that's out in the world now, so you can hear that and also see the accompanying video wherever you find videos.
Now, is this a song that reflects your youth, per se? I know there's lots of allusions to, I think it seems like, sort of relationships you might have as a child, but I can't tell if that's just metaphorical or...
I mean, I think, gosh, what isn't, really? I mean, I feel like more and more these days when I pay attention to the things that I'm like drawing from in my weird like subconscious, maybe it's like, oh, that definitely is from this thing in my childhood. I don't know. I was thinking a lot about the video embodies follows a certain thing, but the song itself, I think, you know, sort of the allegory of the cave and like sort of things being veiled and how there's like lots of angles that you could look at that from creatively or in a way that feels like you're being stifled. Anyways, that's too involved for this conversation.
It's good to let people make up their own minds. I'm sorry.
I
imposed to ask you a bit more background, but hey, I have you here. Might as well get a little more insight. This is Spoil on the Vine from the excellent new record Still Life by Carson McCone. Carson, this was, for me, very lovely. It's been I'm very happy to get to meet you a little bit this way. I've heard a lot about you, but I haven't actually talked to you that much. So I hope you enjoyed this and that we speak again soon. And I wish you the best of luck with everything in the future.
You as well, Vish. Thank you again. And I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
play. It's okay to misbehave. Playmate, playmate, I'm afraid we've made some mistakes.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Once again, thanks to Carson McHone for appearing on this, the 672nd episode of Creative Control. I know I said that like it was a question. I think that's true. Anyway, let's just go with that. 670. Carson McHone was on the 672nd episode of Creative Control. That's what we're going with, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, hey, guess what? Put out a newsletter in the month of March 2022. So how do you like that? I haven't done that in a while. Hasn't been as monthly as it should be, is what I'm saying here. Anyway, if you want to sign up for the newsletter and learn more about me and find old episodes, please visit my website, which is vishkana.com. Or if you want to pronounce it actually correctly, it's vishkana.com. But I never have. I've already said it wrong for so many years that I can't change it. That's like the Indian pronunciation. You'd say Kanna. But I feel like it's too hard for some people to even say Kanna or Vish, as you may have heard on the show. Let's just go with VishKanna.com still. If you like Creative Control on Facebook, you can follow the show on Twitter at VishCreative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram at VishKanna. VishKanna. Visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. Thanks for doing that. For all of you who are doing it, it's really kind of overwhelming. I mean, it's a modest Patreon as far as Patreons go, but it means a lot because I give so much stuff away for free with the podcast, and then I try to put some bonus features up on the, you know, extra rare whatever stuff on the Patreon, and people seem to like that and want to support the show. So thanks. $6 or more a month grants you access to that exclusive content that I was just talking about. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I will get you one just as soon as is humanly possible and while supplies last. Again, it's monthly. It's flexible. You don't have to do $6. You can do whatever amount you want a month. All of it is appreciated and supports the making of this show, which again is otherwise delivered to most people for free. Thanks again to the fine Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about and place special orders at via their website there, blackbird.ca. And also to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Blackbird, by the way, is located in Calgary and Edmonton, Alberta, just so you know, if you're looking for that record store, the bricks and mortar location. Thanks to Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on the show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Carson. I hope you enjoyed it and her, and we'll check out her music. It's great. And thank you for subscribing to this podcast and telling your friends all about the show and maybe urging them to do the same, and then having like a book club gathering about Creative Control, except it's not about books, it's about the podcast, Creative Control. That's good. And you have chips and soda pop. It's very wholesome. Thank you very much. I will talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.